Today on the 21st Show, we continue our week-long series on the fentanyl crisis with a deep dive into solutions. We'll talk about how state and local governments will be spending the billions of dollars coming from opioid settlements. We'll talk about what does and does not work in treatment. And we'll hear another Illinois story of addiction and recovery from someone who now helps others find their way back from this disease. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. All this week, we've been focusing our program on fentanyl. We heard about the history of how it was created for legitimate medical uses and perverted into a street drug. We heard about how treatment works and ways people are trying to reduce the harm that often accompanies drug use. Yesterday, we talked about the politics of the fentanyl crisis, and tomorrow we'll focus on how we can keep young people from becoming addicted. But today we're going to focus on solutions. Already, state and local governments across the country are spending what will be billions of dollars from legal settlements with opioid manufacturers and pharmacies. We'll also talk about how Illinois can better treat those suffering from addiction. Case in point, a lot of the dialogue around fentanyl focuses solely on the deadly aspects of the epidemic. But every day, there are more stories of people who survive these deadly substances and reclaim their lives from addiction. It's a reminder that hope is not lost. And for that, we are joined now by Christine Pierce, who does community outreach for Carl Recovery, which is part of the Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. Christine, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me today. I'm very grateful to be here.
So you now work in addiction recovery, but before we get into that, I'd love to hear your personal story. What was your life like back prior to the early 2000s, before you were first prescribed some pills for back pain?
I like to say that I was a square, and I came from a square family, and you know, I grew up in a square house, and I had all the opportunities of living in middle class America. I was successful, and I went to school, and I had good grades. I had a talent for basketball, and we lovingly refer to that as a baller.
Yep.
So I had this opportunity to go continue my education through a college that paid me to come play basketball. So that's how I got my bachelor's in social work. And at that time, that humanitarian aspect existed in me because I wanted to help others, right? I wanted to make a difference. And, you know, I had the cape on when I graduated, and I was going to save the world. So at that time, I actually went and worked in a local hospital in Ohio. At that time, that's where I was living, and did case management for people in the community who has mental health. And at that time, substance use wasn't quite on the map in that area yet. So. Yeah. And so I did case management for several years.
And then at some point you go to a doctor, you have some back pain, and the doctor says, here, try this wonder drug. Talk about that. How did that come about?
Okay. So I, you know, I got married and bought a home, and I had 2.5 kids, I like to say. And from my first daughter, my daughter was born first, and this back pain started. I'm pretty tall. So I was picking her up and down, and I go to the doctor, and they prescribe me something for my back pain. Now, I'm given no information about this particular narcotic. Nothing in terms of, you know, it could be potentially addictive or, you know, be careful when you take it, you know, make sure, you know, you're not overusing it. And it was, you know, OxyContin. And I had no idea. I had no idea the rabbit hole that my life was about to go down. You know, prior to that moment, I had never been exposed to any kind of illegal substances. I was just like your binge drinker in college, and, you know, the social circles I navigated and the environment that I grew up in, I was not ever exposed to any of that. So.
And so now you're taking this medicine. The doctors haven't, as you said, they haven't warned you that it's a problem, but you begin to have a problem with it, right? You're taking more and more. You need more to.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I said that, you know, the bottle says take as needed. So, you know, when one didn't work, I took two. And, you know, the justification, of course, is the doctor prescribed it and it's helping my pain. And the problem really showed up when all the pills were out, right? And when the doctor said, you know, we could no longer provide refills on this medication, that's when the getting and using, and we say finding ways and means to get more started for me. So,
and ultimately you switch from pills to something a little more potent, a little more direct. Yeah.
So I switched, you know, my story is not new. I'd like to say that. You know, I ended up being a heroin user, and that is not unusual for people who were exposed to OxyContin. As you know, that they decided like to crack down on, you know, the prescriptions and the amount of, you know, pills and the places that you could get them. And so basically the supply ran out. And on the other side of that, you have people who are addicted who have no solution. There's nothing in the middle of that because they're looking at the drug, right? And not the focus is not on the people whose lives have been ruined, right? Impacted, and what supports they need to navigate that. So left with that, heroin was the next thing. Heroin became available through the places, you know, that I would go to find the pills, because, you know, the supply wasn't what it used to be. And that's where that started.
How did opioid addiction affect your life, right? Your career, you talked about your family, your relationships.
It slowly destroyed all of those things. You know, at the time, it was hard for me to come to a place that said, maybe I have a problem, right? And the people around me did not understand what was happening to me, because there were consequences, right? I lost my job, and my family, you know, stopped inviting me to things, and, you know, they weren't calling me, and I had a number of arrests, and, you know, I'd been on probation, and I went to drug court. I mean, and my life was absolutely unmanageable on the outside, right? All the signs were there, you know, all the consequences, and I couldn't stop, right? And that's the one thing I say a lot is, there's no question in my mind, you know, that substance use is, you know, I have a substance use disorder because I cannot stop. And it didn't matter what consequence they put in place. You know, it might keep me from that for a moment, right? But I couldn't achieve any kind of long-term stopping.
Christine, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. And we're going to pause on that. And I want to return to you throughout our conversation today, because fortunately, where we've come to at this point is not the end of your story. You do find treatment and recovery. And we're going to talk about that a little later. I do want to remind listeners, if you or someone you know is suffering from a substance use disorder, there is help available. You can contact the Illinois Helpline at 1-833-2-FIND-HELP or visit helplineil.org. I also want to introduce one of our other guests now. We are joined by Aneri Pitani, senior correspondent at KFF Health News. She has spent the past year looking at what state and local governments across the country are doing with opioid settlement money, right? These are governments that went to court with the companies that enabled addictions like the one we've just been hearing about. And they now have agreed to pay billions of dollars to state and local government. Aneri, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So can you remind us a little bit more? I mentioned just briefly those legal settlements. Who were the major players involved? How did that all play out?
Yeah, so as you heard from, you know, the personal story so poignantly shared at the beginning of this show, lots of folks were getting addicted from medications prescribed by their doctors. And as this became a larger and larger societal issue, thousands of cities, counties, and states decided to sue the companies that were manufacturing these opioids, that were distributing them, the pharmacies that were selling them, for negligence and misleading marketing that was leading them to be so widely proliferated. So you ended up with lawsuits against companies like Johnson & Johnson, AmerisourceBergen, Cardinal, McKesson, CVS, Walmart, Walgreens. There's more than a dozen of them. And rather than sort of fight off, you know, thousands of individual lawsuits, most of these companies decided to settle. And their settlements are, you know, paying out somewhere altogether over $50 billion that will come over 18 years in varying amounts to each state and each city and county government.
What is that money supposed to be used for?
So it's meant to be used to address the overdose crisis, right? It's money that arrived because of the opioid issue. And so it's meant to be used to rectify that issue. In the settlement agreements specifically, most of them say states have to use at least 85% of the money they're getting for, the term is opioid remediation, but basically things that prevent addiction, treat addiction, help people in recovery. That's what it's meant for.
Can you say how much money Illinois is getting or is going to be getting from this settlement?
So the exact numbers are a little bit in flux. Some of these are still, you know, making their way through the courts and finalizing. But the state of Illinois reported that as of last fall, September 2023, the state had already received $190 million, a little over that. And estimates are that over the full 18-year period, they should get close to $1 billion.
And how is that money? Can you talk about how it's being divvied up between the state and local governments? And I don't know if there's any evidence of what governments are already doing with this money that has started to roll in.
Yeah, so let's start with how it's split up, because this is different in every state. So in Illinois, what the state decided to do is 55% of the money, so the bulk of it, goes to this state trust fund for opioid remediation. And that's controlled by a steering committee that basically decides how they want to use the money across the state. The other, the rest of the money, 25% goes directly to local governments. So that means, you know, county commissioners, city council folks are in charge of how to spend it. And 20% goes to the state government. And so their agencies get to decide how to use it. So far, I think we have the most information about what's been done from the state level, from the state trust fund, because there's a public website called ilopioidsettlements.com that they've created, where it shows basically they've approved close to $80 million for things like buying naloxone, which is the medication that reverses opioid overdoses, almost $18 million to invest in treatment services. They've given about $18 million for prevention programs as well. And then at the local level, we have a little less information because there's just no centralized reporting place where governments are saying, here's how we spent this money. So it's a little more piecemeal, but we know, for example, DuPage County is using $850,000 to staff a crisis recovery center. So they're going to hire a lot of employees like psychiatric nurses, crisis counselors, peer specialists for that place. Other counties, Kane County is giving about $100,000 to their county sheriff to start up a forensic lab. Other counties are buying naloxone or working on prevention efforts in schools.
Okay, you mentioned the county sheriff in there and starting up a lab. I wonder, how do we know, or what are the safeguards that say, that make sure this money is going to be focused on getting people treatment, for example, and not, a third armored vehicle for some county sheriff's office or something like that?
Yeah, this is where things get a little tricky because, as I said, in the national settlement agreements, it says 85% of the money has to be used for opioid remediation, but there's not a lot of teeth to it. There are not great enforcement mechanisms. In the national agreements, basically what it says is the companies that settled, the Johnson and Johnsons, the AmerisourceBergens, the Walmarts, if they notice that a state is not living up to that 85% standard, they can take the state back to court. But from all the legal experts I've spoken to, I mean, the companies really have no incentive to try to monitor how states are using the money, and they certainly don't want to bring these court cases back up. They want to pay and move on. So really what we have is the public monitoring, advocates monitoring, people with lived experience who care about how this money is being used. They're the ones who have to go to their local elected officials and say, how are you doing this? Or, monitor the state's spending website and say, are these reasonable uses of the money? And different states have created, some have been more transparent, others less. Some have, opportunities for the public to comment on how they want the money used and to be able to say, do we want it spent on law enforcement and
Or
efforts
treatment,
to
yeah.
crack down on drug trafficking, or
All
do we
right,
want it to be
pardon
spent
my
on
interruption.
treatment?
We need to take a break on the program. We are going to continue talking about the opioid settlement money, and we're also going to come back to Christine Pierce's personal story after a short break here on the 21st Show. Do please stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and all this week we have been talking about fentanyl and the opioid crisis. Today we're focusing on solutions to that, how we can all come together and help our fellow Americans out of addiction and substance use disorder. We began our program with Christine Pierce, who does community outreach. She was sharing her own story of addiction and recovery. We're going to return to that in a moment. We've also been speaking specifically about the billions of dollars that governments, state and local governments across the country, are going to have to spend and have already begun spending from legal settlements with the companies that manufactured the pills that got into the opioid crisis in the first place. There are also pharmacies involved in that. We're talking about this with Aneri Patani, who's a senior correspondent at KFF Health News. And Aneri, I'm going to let you go in just a moment, but I do want to ask you, I want to actually play a soundbite from a conversation we had on the program earlier this week on who is affected by the fentanyl crisis. This is from a man named Chris Schaffner. He's the director of an organization called Jolt, which works on harm reduction and overdose prevention in Peoria, Illinois. And he had this to say about how that settlement money is being used.
We're already seeing evidence that this money is being co-opted by large healthcare systems. And this, most harm reduction programs are not embedded in health departments. They're small, standalone CBO nonprofits like mine. And so often we don't have the grant writing capacity, we don't have the staffing, we lack funding. And so being able to access that money is a challenge.
And Eric, can you speak to that?
Absolutely. I think what I just heard resonates with conversations I've been having across the country where smaller grassroots groups, often harm reduction groups, often mothers who have lost their kids to overdose and are, you know, out on the street trying to help people who are in addiction, or small groups serving meals to people who are living on the street. Organizations like that are really concerned that they are not going to see the opioid settlement dollars reach them, because they're controlled by governments and they often have to go through these RFP, these grant request processes. And if you are an organization of one or two or three people, where, you know, the people on the street are also the CEO and are also the grant writer and the finance person, it can be hard to have an application that's going to compete with a larger health system or a county agency or a sheriff's department. And the concern is, of course, that a lot of those places are already receiving other funding to address opioid use and substance use, but these smaller organizations feel like the opioid settlement money is a new stream, and it should perhaps go to places that are not already seeing other funds.
Can you be more specific about that? I mean, what are you hearing from people? You've spoken with grieving family members. You've spoken with people who themselves have gone through recovery and are now paying that forward. How do they want to see this money spent?
I think a lot of them want to see it spent on things that will keep people alive is I guess the simplest way to phrase that, whether that is treatment. But what they mean by treatment is, you know, facilities that when someone is ready, they will, you know, enter the facility right away, not with a 1 week wait time, not a facility that says you have to already be abstinent and not using any drugs before we allow you to come in and treat. They basically want really low barrier stuff, so when someone says I'm ready for treatment, they can get in. There's also a big push for wanting money to go to housing, because a lot of folks, that's sort of a first step. Often if they don't have safe housing, it's really hard to stop using drugs and to focus on all these other things. So what's called low barrier housing is a lot of, there's a lot of push for that. As well as job training. You know, if we say people need to stop using drugs, go through treatment, when they get out, they need to have a way to rebuild their lives and have workplaces that are ready and willing to hire them and look past, you know, they may have some crimes on their record or they may have some drug use, but looking at, you know, this is a person in recovery who needs to come back and be integrated into our society and has purpose and has all this great experience that they can share. So I think building programs like that is what I'm hearing from a lot of families, what they want.
Aneri Patani is a senior correspondent at KFF Health News. She has been covering the opioid settlements, one of a relatively small number of reporters who is keeping tabs on this. Thank you so much for being with us to share your reporting with us. We'll have a link to it on our website. Aneri, thank you again for joining us on the 21st show.
Thank you for talking about this important topic.
If you're just joining us, we have been focusing on the ongoing fentanyl crisis all week. Today, we are exploring solutions to that. We just heard about how opioid settlement money is being used to fight the epidemic and how we're going to focus, or I should say now, we are going to focus on how professionals have been helping those suffering from addiction. By the way, you can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Christine Pierce, I want to bring you back into our conversation now. Christine is a community outreach worker for Carl Recovery, which is part of the Carl Foundation Hospital in Champaign-Urbana. And Christine, when we left off with your story, and I do want to ask you about that opioid settlement money, but I want to get back to your personal story. What was the turning point for you that ultimately set you on the path to recovery from opioid addiction?
So this is my favorite part of my experience to share, is the hope. And I get a little emotional. So being in recovery.
It's an emotional topic.
Right?
Yeah.
The best part of being in recovery is that I'm alive, that I'm alive to experience it. A lot of people never get to this place, right? And our peers, right, are suffering, as you said, and they're dying every day. I think it's every 15 minutes. You know, they put all these stats out. But my turning point was this moment where I came to an admission that I couldn't live my life like this anymore, and that I couldn't even stand to look at my own self, right? And I thought I really need to get some help, right? I need to get some help. I don't want to die, basically. And we use the term rock bottom a lot. And I prefer to say that I was living on the bottom, right? Because I had a lot of bottoms during active use. And none of them stopped me, right? I mean, you know, forcing me into treatment and, you know, telling me what I need to do and meeting me at this place that says, you know, you got to stop before we can help you. None of those things were effective for me. So when I said, you know, there's got to be something else, right? There's got to be some hope for my life. I actually called a Carl Addiction Recovery outpatient and found myself walking through their door. And, you know, I'm in the waiting area and I'm in full-blown heroin withdrawal and I'm throwing up in the trash can and I'm being a little disruptive, right? Because, like, I need help right now, right now. And that's not how it works when you're in the waiting area, right? And eventually I went back to see a man named Dr. Hill who he did something for me that no one had done in the 10 years. Look, 10 years, it took me 10 years to get one day. That man showed compassion. And he talked to me with humanness. And he reached his hand across the table. And he grabbed my hand. And he looked at me and he said, "It's going to be okay, Christine." And that was my moment. Because that's the thing that I needed the whole time, was just someone to show me some humanness and some love and some compassion. And it was we're going to get through this, right? And prior to that moment, it's always been, you got to do this, right? And fix this problem. And we don't want to talk about it. It was always the big elephant in the room. And it was so shameful, right? And I felt so guilty. And that shame and that guilt kept me in a cycle for a very, very long time. And he didn't meet me there, right? He didn't judge me. He didn't tell me what to do. I hadn't had anyone reach their hand out to me like that in 10 years. And that's where it all started for me. And I haven't looked back since then, right? And I'm coming up this March. I'll celebrate 7 continuous years of being in recovery. And it's hard to put words to the gratitude that I have for the gift, because it really is a gift that I've been given.
What have these, as you said, nearly 7 years, and congratulations on that. What has that been like for you?
It's been a beautiful, I say it's been a beautiful ride, right? It's been a beautiful ride. You know, the experience, right, of learning how to live life. And more importantly, how to feel and experience the full range of feelings that come along with life. The joys, you know, the sadness, the disappointments, the accomplishments, all of it. And I have not done this alone. And I just want to say that's probably the most important thing, is I had to step into the recovery community like full force and surround myself with people who understood and had the empathy to be able to speak to me in a language that did not require words, right? Because they understood the horrors of active addiction, that, and they were moving in a direction, right, where they wanted to improve their lives. And so I followed their way, right? And they, as a community, as the we talk about the we a lot, we help each other, you know? And I say experience is what you get when you don't get what you want, right? And you keep going, you know? We say no matter what, you keep going. So you know, it's been amazing. It's been amazing. I have a beautiful life today. I have a beautiful life. And that's not outside, right? That's not the things outside of myself that define that for me. Like, I'm someone who finds joy in living, and I can feel loved, and I can give love. I have a relationship. My daughter's in the studio, right? Because the relationship with both of my children has been repaired and restored, and they've become phenomenal people. And now I get to help others who were in the same place that I was. So
yeah, you're paying it forward, as they say. I want to take this moment to bring another voice into our conversation now, and that is Michael Dennis, who is director of research at the Lighthouse Institute, part of Chestnut Health Systems, started in Bloomington Normal. Illinois has grown from there. Most of his research focuses on behavioral health and substance abuse. He's with us to talk about how we can help more people get into recovery. Michael, welcome to the 21st show. As you're listening to Christine share her story, I wonder what's going through your mind.
Well, I think the first thing is how she's not alone. We really benefit from the lived experience of people who've survived addiction and gone on to recovery. As I'm listening to it, I think one of the things that people may or may not realize is that addiction is a brain condition in which the substances have damaged the brain. And like any other kind of rehabilitation, it takes time. Most people will use for 50% of the people use for up to 25 years before they can get out of addiction. And it may take them 3 to 4 episodes of treatment over 8 to 9 years before they're able to sustain it for a year or more. But here's the thing we don't dwell on, the hope. And that is that 2/3 of the people who have ever been addicted, not just to opioids, but cocaine, alcohol, you name it, 2/3 of everybody who's ever been addicted are actually in recovery today. And it's gone from being something that was hidden and not talked about to something now that is celebrated. We're learning more and more from people like Christina about what helps them achieve and sustain it. And while treatment helps people stop and addresses the multiple co-occurring problems, it doesn't typically help them sustain recovery. And like Christina found that in her recovery community organizations, in her own outreach, other mutual aid type situations like self-help, that turns out to be the common way that people who sustain recovery are able to do it with the help of other people.
You know, we need to take a break in a couple of minutes here, but before we do, Michael, can you just elaborate a little more? You talked about this with one of our producers about addiction as a chronic disease, right? We sometimes treat it like, I don't know, a broken foot, whereas we need to think of it as a heart condition or cancer or something like that.
Yep. Yeah. It's one of the top 10 chronic conditions that drive death and healthcare costs. And yet it's the only one of the 10 that doesn't have a strong focus on prevention, early intervention, and long-term disease management. One of the things we study is how to do recovery management checkups and how to stay in the game with the people like Christina who may need to check in, particularly in the first months of treatment, the first 11 months of treatment, 2/3 relapse. But if they make it past a year, only about 1/3 relapse in the next 3 years. If they make it past 3 years, only about 14% relapse. If they make it past 7 years, it's more like 7%. So there is a decreasing risk, just like you see in cancer. But if there's changes in life circumstances or events, if they're not support in a supportive recovery environment, the risk of relapse never goes away. And like diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, once you've got one of those diagnoses, you're always at risk. And it's all about how well you can manage it and how well the people, you and the people around you support your efforts to stay in recovery.
All right, we're going to continue this conversation after the break. We are talking with Michael Dennis of Chestnut Health Systems. He's director of research at the Lighthouse Institute there. Also, Christine Pierce, who's a community outreach worker with Carle Recovery, part of the Carle Foundation Hospital. More to come. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are continuing our week-long series of conversations on fentanyl, today focusing on solutions to the crisis. We've been hearing all throughout our hour from Christine Pierce, her own story of addiction and recovery, and now she works to help other people seek recovery as a community outreach worker through Carle Recovery, which is part of the Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana. We're also speaking with Michael Dennis, who is director of research at the Lighthouse Institute, part of Chestnut Health Systems, which began in Bloomington Normal, Illinois. 800-222-9455 is the number to join our conversation today. Just about 14 minutes left in the program. Christine, I want to ask you, we heard Michael there talking about this idea of ongoing recovery is a process. It's not something that ever ends. What does it look like for you these nearly 7 years on? Are you continuing to see a counselor, if you're willing to speak to it, medication-assisted treatment? What's that like for you?
Sure. So, yeah, I'm glad he brought up that we're never cured, right? I'm never recovered, right? I am in recovery, and I'm always in a process, right? And there are lots of pathways, I just want to say, to and for recovery. And for me individually, you know, I subscribe to abstinence, and, you know, I'm part of a 12-step program. So there's, you know, tools and resources and things within that particular program that I have to continually use, right? And I have to continually show up and be involved and give back as well. And yes, I do have a therapist that I see regularly, because you know, it takes a long time, right? It takes a long time to the healing process, you know, with my own self, because you know, I could still say my thinking can still be negative, right? And I could still be at a war within me, you know, as if I'm not good enough, or I don't fit in, or you know, those things that sometimes we tell ourselves, and that really, it gets better. It has gotten better. It's gotten so much better, but it never really completely goes away. So that's what's worked for me, and service, right? Service in my life really is so valuable. The easiest way that I stop focusing on my own self and my own problems and my own thinking is I help somebody else, and that could be in a lot of different ways. Because recovery is really, really about how we live our lives, right? It's about how are you putting, you know, am I putting the card away? Am I saying thank you? Am I smiling? You know, just sometimes it's just the smallest things that make a difference in my day for me, and just make me better as like being a human, being, you know, in the world, practicing some humanness.
I do want to I want to bring in one more voice into our conversation today. We had reached out to another expert for this, Dr. Lorianne Post, who works on health policy and economics at Northwestern's medical school. She couldn't join us live today, but one of our producers spoke with her on Tuesday. Let's listen to just a little bit of what she had to say about the history of opioid addiction in the United States.
We've had an opioid problem dating back to the beginning of the United States. So, you know, just a note, at the end of the Civil War, there were approximately 500,000 persons who were dependent on morphine and Dilaudid and whatever, because of injuries that men sustained during the Civil War. And so they were overprescribed or overgiven, you know, painkillers, and it led to mass addiction.
So, Michael, I want to bring you back into the conversation and sort of take a bigger picture look here. I mean, this came up on the program yesterday. It's come up earlier this week. This does seem to be a uniquely American epidemic with pretty deep roots here. Why do so many of our fellow Americans end up using drugs, getting this disease where they become addicted to these substances?
It's not as uniquely American as you might think. It certainly exists in many other countries, although the prevalence does move around. Part of it has to do with the degree of economic disparity. Part of it has to do with the degree our society tends to rely a lot on medication, because the way our healthcare system is set up, the pharmaceuticals are for profit and push physicians and others to use medications. And that has led to some negative effects. We are blessed with a great medical system, great medical people, and great medicine, but we do both under and over prescribe at the same time. So I don't know that it's unique to us. We do have right now the fentanyl, which is well over 10 to 100 times, depending on who you listen to, more powerful than heroin, is being intentionally added to the drug supply, in part because it's cheaper than heroin and other prescription drugs. It's stronger. And so you can think of it as like spiking the punch or spiking a drink with vodka. It makes it stronger. And it is being intentionally added way upstream, where even the person selling it may not know the contents of it. The most recent effect is not only the spread of fentanyl into heroin and stimulants like cocaine, it's now also showing up in counterfeit medication that's being sold to teenagers and young adults who don't even realize that they're using an opioid, and now have had some of the most dramatic increases in their number of overdoses just in the past 2 years.
And we actually heard from somebody who called in earlier this week to talk about their own child's death related to just that exact circumstance you were talking about. Christine, I do want to ask you about your work in the recovery community, because there is now this new effort at Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana. You're part of a team. Some people on the team talk to people actually in the emergency room. I understand you're out in the community talking with people. What does that work like? How do those conversations go?
Well, just to have a voice and to be invited to the table is powerful, right? And, you know, decisions about what to do with people who have substance use disorder being made for a very long time without the people who are experiencing it. So, you know, my role is outreach at Carle is to start changing the conversation, right? And to start looking at the solutions, right? We start looking at the people, because, you know, we focused on the drugs, right? And how they get here and all of that, right? And there's been books written about, you know, treatment. But my focus is to say, like, there is hope, right? And I understand where you are, but I'm going to meet you where you're at, right? So you tell me, right, what you're willing to do today for recovery, right? Because most people they want to stop, right? Most people, you know, don't want to continue to be where they are, and just letting them know that someone cares and that I understand because I've been where you're at is huge. There's something about, you know, when we help each other, you know, people with lived experience, when we help each other. And I also, you know, talk with organizations, businesses, other people in the community, and try to educate them on the language of recovery, right? And also the disease of addiction, like in the stigma, right? Because that's been a big thing for a very long time. So the movement is more towards recovery-oriented language and accepting people where they are, because we have to remember these are people who are suffering. They're not numbers. They're people.
What is it, do you think, when somebody, I'm imagining, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm imagining someone would say, wow, that's, you know, great, you made that recovery. You must be stronger than I am. I'm not strong enough. I can't do it. What do you tell people? What is it? Is there something about you, do you think, that powered you through this journey?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. There's no magic bullet. There's no, you know, quick fix. There's no, you know, one shot. I encourage them that it's possible for them too, right? It's possible for them too. So, and we start somewhere, right? The goal is to finish, right? I always say the goal is just to start, right? We just start somewhere. Of course, you talked about, you know, the naloxone, which is, we refer to it, you know, as Narcan, a lot of people know. And that's also part of what we do with outreach is we start that conversation, what it is, getting it out to the community where it's visible, is super, super important. And so that probably is, you know, cause we give hope, right? We give hope and, you can't buy hope, right?
No.
You can't buy hope. You can't put hope in a book. And you can't, you can't package it, right? Like the hope that we have for each other, because when I say there's hope, man, right? We just start. They understand, like, because people with lived experience, right? We have credibility. We have credibility, and that's the one thing that I think gets people's attention. That are still in active addiction is, oh my gosh, really? And sometimes people will say to me, I would have never known that was your story. Because my life does look different today. So.
And you're giving people hope.
That's right. That's right.
Do you find they're receptive to that message? What does it take? Mm.
So I give out a lot of hugs, right? And it opens the, a lot of times when I say that and I, you know, the hope, it opens the space for the other person to start talking, right? And whether that's about where they're at, where they've been, right? But they feel safe enough in that space to start talking about some of the things that are affecting them, right? Maybe how they feel about themselves or their living condition or, you know, what they want for themselves or their kids or their job. And it just creates a dialogue, right, between us. And we start building relationship because, you know, part of it, that's part of what I do too, is, you know, I try to stay consistent and, you know, keep showing up, visibly showing up, and just being available and a lot of times just a hug. There's so much in a hug. It's so simple, but there's a whole conversation when you hug someone who's in pain.
Christine Pierce, I want to thank you so much for being with us to share your story with us. And thank you for doing the work that you do, spreading hope in our communities. I'm sure there are a lot of other families who are grateful for that as well. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Dennis, I also want to thank you for joining us today and sharing your perspective. Thank you for joining us here on the 21st Show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks also to Dr. Lorianne Post, couldn't be with us, and Aneri Patani, who joined us earlier this hour. We're going to conclude our week-long focus on fentanyl tomorrow by talking specifically about and with young people. we've come a long way from that cracked egg in the frying pan commercial, the Just Say No campaigns of the 1980s. What works? What doesn't? What do young people need to know? What messages are young people hearing? What messages do parents need to hear? That's something else that came up earlier this week. We're going to talk all about that tomorrow on the 21st show. If you have a question you want us to address, you want to comment, please call in during the show, or you can leave us a voicemail ahead of time at 217-300-2121. You can also email us a question. All the ways to contact us are at our website, 21stshow.org. Our program is produced by Christine Hatfield, Kennedy Vincent, and Jose Zepeda, with special contributions this week from Christine Herman. Technical direction and engineering from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.